For someone who doesn't really believe in ghosts, I love a good haunted house story. Because every movie about a haunting is a blend of different genres. Stories like The Changeling or Stir of Echoes play as mysteries, whodunits, between the land of the living and the land of the dead. All the same, movies like Event Horizon have made sci-fi horror out of a haunted house story. Or Beetlejuice, a horror comedy that serves as a behind the scenes of a haunting. Other stories run the gamut. Haunted houses as portals, tombs, boats. All where characters find themselves pulled into someone else's narrative. Sometimes tragedies that have been running on a loop for ages. For this episode, we picked a cross-section of haunted house stories, and things got out of control, and before we knew it, we had two episodes worth. So we're going to be splitting this into a series between 2 weeks. This first part, where we discuss the original Amityville Horror from 1979 and the animated Monster House from 2006. Next week, we'll be submitting to you our episode on Stanley Kubrick's take on Stephen King's The Shining.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
It's the kind of house they don't build anymore. A relic of a time when the world wasn't in such a hurry. When there was still time for a little charm and elegance. It has stood empty for a long while. And at the price, it is a bargain. For a growing young family, it is almost too good to be true.
What do you think?
I love it.
James Brolin, Margot Kidder, Rod Steiger, in the Amityville Horror.
So it's been sequelized, it's been adapted, it's been documented, it's part of its own documentary, as well as whatever the Warrens eventually showed up, but we're talking about the original, 1979, the Amityville Horror.
Yes, so many of these.
Yeah, it's a weird subject to flood the market with. I guess it's kind
but
of
it
America's go-to haunted house.
Yeah, every now and then it just becomes a huge push for Amityville.
And there's a new one now that I think it's the Amityville Haunting that came out this year in a really weird release pattern.
I'll probably watch it, honestly, because I seem to watch anything that's Amityville related. Documentaries, everything.
So you read the book, that was Jay Anson writing the book?
Yes, Jay Anson wrote that book.
Wait, but so Jay Anson wrote the book, but it's the Lutzes who actually lived in the house.
Right. It's Jay Anson wrote the book as told through the story by George Lutz.
Okay.
And
okay.
His wife.
And this screenplay is adapted by Sandor Stern. I guess Jay Anson might have tried his hand at the script of it, but they did not go for that.
Right. And I could see that, though. It's a very flowery. So the actual Amityville Horror book is it's not a thick book, but honestly, it could probably be like a novella.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
it's a simple story, but he makes it very
the time
fanciful.
Spent in that house. It seems like you would have to invent a number of things to really flesh out a full story.
Yes. So yeah, Sandor Stern, he comes in, he writes the screenplay, directed by Stuart Rosenberg, and that's about all you can really say about that.
I had a really hard time contextualizing this movie, because okay. I'm relatively familiar with the original story, and I've seen bits and pieces of documentaries, and you know, if you follow the Warrens, they also ingratiated themselves to the family, and try to make themselves part of the story.
Yes.
So like I
that's a good way to put that.
So a number of things are spoiled for me. I knew, you know, all the sort of cultural touchstones as far as the Get Out, the you know, house talking to you, the bleeding walls, all that shit is pretty familiar. The little kid who wasn't supposed to be there showing up in the photograph overnight. So like that kind of stuff I'm familiar with.
And so I don't know what I was expecting exactly out of this, but I came away feeling this is a weird pull. It was a well-made movie for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it borrowed liberally from any number of different stories and movies. And so for that reason, it felt a little bit like The Burning. Do you remember the 1982 slasher?
Yes.
That is pretty much like an amalgamation of a number of camp slasher movies. It just happens to do it very well.
I could see that. I mean, I think you have to think about this. The book comes out in 1977. The film comes out in 79. And in between these times, you have the Lutzes on major TV shows in America. They're talking about their story. They're telling it like it's the gospel truth at this time.
Oh, right.
It's still really, you know, at this point in time, everyone thinks this is a real thing.
Gotta maintain that fame.
Yeah, and because the situation is such a strange thing, and because the internet doesn't exist, and so we have, you know, the history of the DeFeos that happened, like, in 74, the DeFeo murders. No one knows the real ins and outs of it because there's no internet. So they know this crazy mystery murder happened, then these people move in, then they leave.
Yeah.
They think it's people, I think, thought, you know, hey, this is based on a true story.
Yeah.
Because and that's they, how it was being sold.
Right. They pushed it until they couldn't push it anymore.
Right.
Oh, no. I'm coming apart! Oh, Mother of God, I'm coming apart!
Yeah, okay, so Stuart Rosenberg, the director of this, he did direct Cool Hand Luke, so he was a somebody. He also did Pope of Greenwich Village, which I haven't seen, but whatever. Charlie, they took my thumbs, Charlie.
Cool Hand Luke, though, fine. Yes, I get that.
Okay, so starring James Brolin and Margot Kidder as the Lutzes.
Yeah.
And we've got Rod Steiger as Father Delaney. This had come out the year before The Changeling with George C. Scott. And I like that they incorporated heavies, like real legit actors of their day into genre pieces, especially, you know, movies like The Exorcist and The Omen that this followed, where these are meant to be like surreal circumstances facing very real human beings dealing with day to day. And I love that about 70s movies that are always like sort of slice of life stories.
Yes. They don't Americana until suddenly it's not.
Right. And they don't like, you know, a lot of times they don't necessarily like even force structure on you. And so you don't, you know, it's hard to predict where those stories are going to go.
Right.
This a little bit less so because whatever it claimed to have been based on a true story. And when it was certainly riding that wave.
Yes. Yes, it was. But it's always worth looking into any of these. I love Amityville. And like I told you, I think I've seen probably every single one of these films, every freaking documentary, it seems, because I just go through phases. When a new one comes out, then they push all this other Amityville stuff on you. And I go, okay, fine. You know, I've watched so many documentaries on the DeFeo murders. It's like not even exciting anymore, which is disappointing.
Yeah. And there's the creepy My Amityville haunting.
Yeah, where which is just
it's
sad.
The kid who was in the house for some of it.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. He was one of her kids that was in the house.
That's right. Because
it's like a Brady Bunch situation.
Yeah, but they're all her kids, aren't they?
Mm hmm.
Okay, so James Brolin, I don't remember what his character, but the
George
senior
Lutz.
Oh, it's George? George Lutz. Okay, well, it's not a given to me. I haven't read and watched all the shit. But, okay, so George Lutz is coming into this setting. In this case, Margot Kidder is meant to have had three children, all pretty close in age. Like, she seems a touch too young. I mean, you know, whatever.
She looks great,
Hollywood.
Though, in this film. Like,
she's gorgeous.
Margot Kidder at her best, really, in this film.
So between, in a couple of minutes, we'll be talking about Shelley Duvall as her role, Wendy in The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
And so between, like, Shelley Duvall and Margot Kidder, and it's funny, we just recorded an It episode, but Annette O'Toole also, like, these were all childhood crushes of mine. And
really?
So I'm a late comer to the Amityville horror. If I had watched this as a kid and seen some of the boob reveal, I might have lost my fucking mind.
Margot Kidder's fashion in this film. Well, everyone's fashion in
this
film.
She's also dressed as a Catholic schoolgirl at one point. Like, I was a little... I mean, it's just a skirt and, like, a button-down shirt, but
she's
still.
She's very religious.
I kind of assume that, her Catholicism is relative... Is she an educator? She... working at a Catholic school. I don't know why she's wearing that skirt.
She's just very religious.
Yeah, but it's a plaid skirt, like out of a Catholic school uniform.
It's 1979, apparently. That's what everyone did.
Okay. I kind of lumped it in. Later on, someone tells George Lutz, like, you know, you change your religion for this woman, like, and you're like, you're not you anymore. And so I just thought, like, well, there's a lot of Catholicism in this movie.
Yeah, that's kind of because even her, you know, aunt or cousin, aunt is a nun, oh, yeah. And she's very religious. Because you always think, like, why would you bring a priest in to bless a house you just, is that a normal thing people do?
Right, and that priest is so familiar, he's just going to walk into an empty house uninvited and just, like, start business without anybody else around. Like, that
doesn't
was...
need to be invited?
No.
As is common with many Catholic families, Mrs. Lutz asked her parish priest to stop by and bless the house. This blessing began in the sewing room and seemed to set off a chain reaction which would jeopardize the lives of everyone involved.
And also, okay, so the movie starts out with the DeFeo murders, and we get like glimpses of those that we later will flash back into. Mm-hmm. But so we go from the DeFeo murders to the house purchase, and then we cut to a month later, and that's when the priest shows up. In that case, it's a... what's his face? It's Rod Steiger. And so the house, we're led to believe that he's the first person that the house fucks with. And I thought, like, a month? Like, if you really wanted them out, you'd get them while they were, like, before they started unpacking. Like,
it's
you don't.
True. You'd, like, well, they're very, like, stubborn, also.
I thought maybe he was triggered by this very Catholic presence. I mean, later they kind of go into some nonsense about
portals to hell.
So you're
saying that if the priest had never been invited, Jody probably would not have fucked with the family at all?
They do unpack that crucifix, and that does seem to irk the house, so maybe that would have been the first trigger. The house is triggered.
So if, like, myself or, like, me and Jackson and the dog moved into that house, the house would have been fine with us being
probably
there.
Probably not. No, it was a couple of Satanists. Why not? More for the party. Wait. Exactly.
It's just because they were so religious. That's an interesting idea.
Because otherwise it doesn't make sense. Because otherwise the house is just dormant for that extra month. Like, it's been lived in this whole time. They've been unpacking little by little. And, like, you know, I'm sure every homeowner's lease has, like, the equivalent of a lemon law where, like, if the walls bleed, we get to leave.
Yes, actually, that is a case. That is true.
Yeah.
Just so you know, in New York, if you ask if that house is haunted... and you can do this for renting as well. If you ask if the house is haunted and they tell you no, it's not, and then you think yes, it is, then you can move the fuck right out, and that lease is no good.
Someone is under a legal obligation to answer the question, is this house haunted?
Yeah.
Honestly?
And I legit ask everyone. You know what I didn't ask in Queens, and I should have.
You should have. That was the most likely house to be haunted, or apartment, as it would be. Yeah. Huh. Wow. Okay. All right.
My
so
house
my hunch
is,
was
is
right.
not haunted. Just
the
so
one
you know.
We're in now?
Is, yes.
Yeah, pretty newly.
Someone did die in 1919 right outside. They fell on the ice, slipped and fell on the ice.
Oh. And
it was in the New York Times.
Cracked their head. Wow. Did you Google your address
yes,
and found that?
Yes, of course.
Ah, okay. Wow.
So you should always ask, Darren.
I should. I
don't know how you've lived in New York this long without asking. Because think about every apartment you're in here.
I felt
someone's
I might
probably died.
Feel a little silly.
No. I'm sure people ask all the time. I do.
I think I also assume that, like, any landlord I'm dealing with is enough of a scumbag who's just going to be like, no one ever died in here. Why would anybody
but
die in
this
apartment?
But then you got them. Because then if you get haunted.
Oh, then we can... try getting that on a renter's insurance form. Haunted. So worth note that this was in AIP Pictures or American International Pictures, who we talked about in depth when it came to Roger Corman's Poe cycle, mm-hmm. because they're the very low budget independent studio that brought you any number of Roger Corman movies. What's the I Was a Teenage Werewolf was one of theirs. Actually, that relates to it. I think that isn't that
yeah,
what's playing.
That's
in
what Richie's
1990s one. Yeah, but okay. So yeah, so this was produced by Samuel Z. Arkoff, one half of the AIP team, and this was a huge success for them. And like we think of it, Amityville Haunting, as far as like it's been done to death. Any number of it, you know, everybody knows the house, what that looks like, even right. though not the house, not what it looks like.
Not like at all anymore. They took those windows away.
Well, I think, so the house in the movie is in Toms River, New Jersey, Amityville's in Long Island.
But it proper. Did have the original windows.
Oh, did it?
And they took them away. Now it has okay. like little portholes, I think.
Yeah, now you, I mean, it still draws people. I think it actually just went up for sale not that long ago. Yeah.
We thought about going to stare at it for a while.
Yeah, we considered that being the like road trip that we would yeah. take on our Killer Cars episode. And actually, relative to that, the movie that we covered in Killer Cars, The Car, also starred James Brolin. In The Car, he's playing the sheriff. He's got a little more charisma. I think part of it might be the story he's involved with. But in this, I felt like his performance is kind of phoning it in. Like he's,
really?
He plays kind
I think
of dour.
Because he's so mad all the time. And no, there are some great scenes where he's chopping wood. So in the beginning, he's chopping
wood.
That wood and she's like got the groceries and she drops it on the ground and she's kind of being a nagging, annoying wife.
Don't ever do that. Not to a man with an axe in his hand.
I just thought maybe I could get a little help. Look what you made me do.
I made you do.
There's a week's worth of groceries rolling down the walk.
Wait a minute till I finish this stuff.
George, finish? You have got enough wood here to heat the whole South Shore.
She's having to carry all the groceries into the house while he's chopping redundant wood at this point. Like,
yeah,
they've got enough for that winter and the next winter.
He's freaking going crazy. Like, you can tell looking at him that he is like a woman on a verge. I don't, there's not a man on a verge. That's not a saying, so I don't know what to say. But then she goes and fucks with him a few more times. And I think that's a great scene. He's great in that.
I think he eventually does slide into, like, you know, creepy territory where, mm-hmm. you know, the house is asserting control over him. But up to that point, like, I don't know, even when everybody, it's funny, it's a very, like, movie device, but when the cast can sort of point at a person and go, like, you look really sick right now. And it's like, we as the viewer, it's like, maybe the makeup wasn't heavy enough to read on camera, but
yeah,
we as
like,
the reader
are
just like, I mean, he's keeping his hands in his pants and he's squinting a lot, but is that what you mean? But he's not feeling well. And that's what I mean as far as like James Brolin not showing as much charisma this time, at least for the first half of the movie. He's just kind of boring stepdad, like kind of.
Yeah, I could see that. Also, the hair and the chops and the beard and everything, he doesn't get a lot of.
No.
Like his face is covered. It's like acting with a mask on.
The brawny paper towels guy they
cast. Yeah. That's like hardly his fault.
I will say he is fun enough. So the house is on the lake, which I guess leads to a river. And so while the priest is in the house and he first comes in to bless, George Lutz is taking the family on a motorboat ride and he books it right out of the boathouse. And I'm thinking like, that is absolutely a low wake area and you are not allowed to go that fast. That is irresponsible. I know you want to be fun stepdad, but really consider your neighbors.
Yeah, but they just moved in. They moved into murder house. The neighbors aren't going to say shit. Because as long as someone's living, they're not murdering each other.
There's that one creepy neighbor who shows up with a six-pack and then disappears.
I think that was a thing they did in the 70s.
But he didn't even leave the six-pack on the door like as a welcome basket.
Oh, he took it with him?
Yeah, seemingly. Yeah.
Oh, I assumed he left it. That's a dick move.
He's just showing off his six-pack. I just came by to say hello and show you my Pabst Blue Ribbon six.
Let's talk about that priest for a second. With all the flies. It's a great scene.
Yeah.
Great
yeah,
scene.
I was thinking about it. Flies might bother me more than like any ground-based creepy crawlies, spiders, ants, etc. Because flies go for your eyes, your ears, your nose, all
yes.
your head holes.
Yeah, they're going to go for any kind of soft tissue that they can get involved in. And that is gross.
Yeah.
That is
yeah,
gross.
That scene was pretty effective.
They got that on him by putting honey all over his face.
Rod Steiger was in on the waterfront.
Like, can you imagine?
We're just going to rub you down.
Like,
honey.
I'm just going to paint some honey all over your face. Just hold so. Oh, maybe they took that bear and just like dripped it all over his face.
I did like the fly imagery in the movie, and there is a lot.
Yes.
There's a lot of like macro shots of giant flies' eyes.
Yeah, that's good.
And there's
good
even like
stuff.
Artwork on the walls. Like, there is a lot of fly visuals throughout the movie. I was actually impressed that between Rod Steiger and George Lutz, Brolin, they both do a good amount of acting with flies on their face, yeah. not reacting to it. Like, I don't think I could do that.
No, that's, I would be like, ugh. I always wonder that because, you know, I grew up on a farm and cows will walk around with flies like right on their eye area.
Yeah.
And like those, occasionally, like
those are the cows have given up on life.
Yeah, they'll swat them off occasionally, but sometimes they'll just like just let it happen.
Yeah.
It's so awful.
It's pretty depressing to see.
Can you imagine giving a really dramatic reading of something with flies walking all over your face? I remember when I watched Dark Shadows, that used to happen to Barnabas a lot. Maybe he coated his face with honey, I'm not sure. But Barnabas would be talking and flies would like land on his head and stuff. And you, and they
and
would
he
be,
would just
yeah,
keep going
the
through
the opposite
lines?
Of David Mamet style acting, because David Mamet says you have to react to whatever's happening to you. But not Barnabas Collins on Dark Shadows. He would just let it land there on his head and then keep talking.
I was thinking about that in terms of like Pigpen from Charlie Brown and Peanuts. That like the it's a very old fashioned thing to like draw someone who's filthy, dirty with flies hovering around them.
That's true.
But like it's a pretty horrifying concept overall. That like unless I don't remember. I guess it was Pigpen in. Like, was Pigpen a zombie? Was Pigpen dead? He was
maybe.
Just like decaying, drawing flies.
Maybe
Charlie
He's
Brown
like
had
their
a zombie friend,
dead zombie ghost friend. Maybe they all got together and accidentally killed him one summer, and he haunts them.
I love that. That Charlie
like in
Brown,
an accident.
It's like if or Pet Sematary. Well, I'm just thinking like Charlie Brown and Company, or what's a better or yeah, Stephen King's The Body, where they're kind of like if they had befriended the dead body and then like,
it just followed them
mannequin
around.
Mannequin him, Weekend at Bernie's. Like that's just our fly gathering friend. That's, he's very quiet.
Because yeah, Pigpen, I don't even think talks. He just sits in his own stink.
The flies be for him.
Jody says everything's gonna get better.
Mm-hmm. What does Jody look like, huh? I mean, is Jody big or thin or fat or?
She's nice.
Mm-hmm.
She tells me things too.
Yeah, like what does she tell you, huh?
She tells me about the little boy who used to live in my room. He got hurt, and he died.
And what else does Jody tell you?
She says she wants me to live here forever and ever, so we can all play together.
When we're initially shown the DeFeo murders and the police showing up and all that, the principal from Back to the Future shows up. It turns out it's just a cameo because they change out detectives halfway through the movie. But yeah, I don't know. Everybody in this movie is somebody. There's even, so Father Ryan is Murray Hamilton, who is the mayor in Jaws. He's randomly there. Everybody in this is somebody. Later on, we've got a newspaper clerk who is Peter Maloney, but everybody would know him as Bennings from John Carpenter's The Thing. Like, everybody in this is somebody. It's a weird, especially for AIP, which was making low-budget movies, you don't always, like, they could afford one main star. In this case, it's Brolin.
I think a lot of people wanted to be involved with it, because the other thing is they were paying in points.
Yeah, yeah. James Brolin made a pretty smart move, taking points on the back end.
Exactly. So, you know, hey, they thought this was going to be popular, and it really was.
Yeah, he made off like a bandit.
Let's just pack up our stuff and go.
Would you please leave that damn fire alarm and listen to me?
I'm not going anywhere. You're the one that wanted a house. This is it, so just shut up.
You bastard.
It's a weird bullet point I've made, but it's here with an asterisk that, I'm still at this point not wild about James Brolin's performance, but kind of feeling that his acting's kind of lame based on how bad his chatter is with his dog. Like when he's alone to talk with his dog, it's kind of like, what are you two, strangers? Did you just meet? What are
no,
you saying?
No, that is really strange. And it makes me think that James Brolin like never had a pet in his life.
Right.
Because you can talk to your dog about anything. Like, it should never sound so weirdly stilted and weird.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the house was meant to have already been affecting. I have no idea.
I like to think of it like, you know, he's like a real actor. And a real actor has to have, you know, someone to play off of. And that dog was giving him nothing. So he was giving it right back.
Towards the end of the movie, when he goes back for the dog, like, I had completely forgotten about the dog. Like, we're not really sold that relationship very well.
It's much better in the Ryan Reynolds Amity, the dog relationship.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. I had very faint memories of that
one. Which I've also seen, obviously.
Yeah, that one I have seen.
And that was fun.
I remember liking it.
I actually liked that one.
Yeah, it kind of felt like kind of low stakes.
And you want to see some angry wood chopping. That one has a lot of angry wood chopping.
Amy, open the door. Amy, I'm in the closet. Open the door. Amy, I mean it. Amy, come to the door. Open it.
Another bullet point is, you remember when tighty whities were the standard?
I like how funny you think.
When they're woken up in the middle of the night, I guess at this point the front door has blown out and the basement door has blown in. I don't remember. It seems as if someone was inside the house trying to get out.
Right.
And Brolin goes to investigate in his underwear, and he spends a substantial amount of time just being a grown man wearing tighty whities.
Like, tighty whities is like really the definition of the word underpants. Underpants. I feel like that's tighty whities. It's such a weird word. But yeah, and they weren't just the regular kind of tighty whities. I feel like they were big. Like, they're very.
You felt they were.
I felt
baggy.
Like, they were long. Like,
what
they
are
go
typically
up
referred to as
high.
Ball huggers were not.
No, they go up very high on his. I was just very. There was a lot of material that goes into making tighty whities. Not so tighty whities.
These might have been like theatrical tighty whities. So he didn't expose anything. He might have been wearing like two ply.
Underpants.
But yeah, later in the story, because why wouldn't he? He steals a book from the library and jams it in his pants and does so, like, pretty forcefully.
There's
and
I'm room just... in the tighty whities, that's why. A lot of stealing from libraries goes on in movies in the 70s. Raised with the Devil, they steal from the library.
They do. I mean, in that case, they try to do it above board, but it turns out, yeah, that was like a reference book.
And in it, they steal from the library as well. Everyone's stealing from the library.
Yeah, well, it was the 80s. It was this was the equivalent of like bootlegging something these days online.
Just
like
stealing it right out.
Illegal download. I'm going to steal it from the library. That is fucking old school. So a familiar name, and The Exorcist has already come into conversation. Lalo Schifrin did the music for this movie and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Score. He didn't win.
No.
He didn't win.
I honestly don't think the music's that great.
I liked it overall. I mean, it's a music-heavy movie. They are leaning into the scares. They are certainly relying on it for builds. But I liked it. I thought the sort of combination of the choral voices and then the sort of same notes being played by violin, yeah, as a back and forth, I dug it. It felt a little bit like the Lullaby and Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
Kind of went after that. Lalo Schifrin had worked with Stuart Rosenberg on Cool Hand Luke. Yeah, I don't know. I like the theme. It is, I don't know. I think in my old age, I'm starting to like less movies that rely on a like constant score. Like, just give us a couple quiet moments. Let us sort of sit with these people and these characters and not rely so much on like blaring jump scares.
Yeah,
like
that makes sense.
There's a not great special effects shot where Margot Kidder touches the crucifix after it falls off the wall. And I think her hands and face are meant to have gotten boils from that moment. But okay, so I think the director recognized that like this effect isn't really working. We'll just kind of nod or swing the camera away from her as soon as possible, because like she gets boils in her hand and then she looks in a mirror and there's boils on her face, but the mirror is like got like veins through it.
Yeah.
So it's like that weird old decorative thing that doesn't get made anymore. But through that, you can kind of see she's got boils on her face, which like between that and the flies, yeah, it's starting to feel pretty biblical.
It's not a lot of special effects in this film.
There aren't. No, they mostly rely on like doors blowing up.
That's
or
the joy of a haunted
or,
house movie.
Yeah, I did like the house screaming. That was unexpected, and that was pretty. I was watching this with headphones on, so it was like the appropriate amount of jarring for me.
I like when it gets angry and angrier, especially in the beginning when it's saying like "get out" quietly, and then they say "get out," and then the priest is like, "What? Me? Me?
Maybe you didn't hear me. I said get out.
Get out. Oh, I guess it's me.
Out."
So this inspired the Eddie Murphy bit, which was essentially ripped off of a Richard Pryor bit.
In the Amityville Horror, the ghost told them to get out the house. White people stayed in there. Now that's a hint and a half for your ass. A ghost say get the fuck out, I would just tip the fuck out the door. They walked and looked in the toilet bowl, was blood in the toilet.
I said, that's peculiar.
I would have been in the house and said, oh baby, this is beautiful. We got a chandelier hanging up here, kids outside playing. It's a beautiful neighborhood. We ain't got nothing to wear. I really love them. This is really nice. Get out. Too bad we can't stay, baby.
But yeah, so the house, impressed. The house is so powerful that down the line, the priest is praying for the house remotely in the church, and the statue starts crumbling, and he essentially goes blind.
Yes.
Like, the Amityville house is like evil Wi-Fi. It will get to you wherever
and
you
that's
are.
That's just not really how haunted houses work. That gets a little... That's where it lost me. No, it's too much. That's too far away. That's ridiculous absurdities.
Yeah, that was... It was kind of like they wanted to keep Rod Steiger in the movie. And, like, my guess is he shot for 3 days.
Right.
And they just intercut all this other stuff. But, yeah, I don't know. It wasn't that kind of haunting.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not like we're talking about The Exorcist where it's, like, a freaking demon who has, like, the ability for far-fetched things. This is literally something which you find... At the end is like, oh, it's based because of the location. It's on this Native American burial ground.
All the traditional tropes.
Yeah, exactly. And so, listen, if it's based on this burial ground, then it's location-based. So you can't – the church is not on the burial ground.
Right.
Only the power lives on the burial ground. And if you walk to the other side of the street, there's no power there.
Yeah, actually, speaking to the host component – this is part of the IMDb trivia page. 1979, attorney William Weber, Ronald DeFeo's defense attorney, filed a lawsuit against George Lutz and Kathy Lutz, charging them with fraud and breach of contract. He alleged that they reneged on an agreement to collaborate with Weber on the book and subsequent movie. In an interview with the Associated Press, Weber admitted that he and the Lutzes had concocted the horror story scam over many bottles of wine.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, okay. Probably not so much a real thing.
No, probably not so much a real thing. I mean, George Lutz definitely knew about the DeFeo murders. It's why he chose that house in particular.
Oh.
He also had quite a book collection of occult books. Really loved that. And that's kind of how Warrens get involved, is George Lutz.
Like, oh, because he would have known of them.
Yeah. And so, I mean, he's really a guy who was obsessed with the occult, comes up with this great location and makes this whole thing up.
Wow.
Which is kind of like disappointing and sad, you know, because you think like maybe there's something to it, but there's not.
Maybe let's make 15 movies about it.
Right. And then people think like, oh, that's a fatal murder. All the bodies were in their beds face down. And then you come to find out that that's not actually exactly the case. It's not really that particularly mysterious of a murder.
Right. If memory serves, like, it was likely that he put them back in their beds.
They think they were
after
placed
shooting.
There.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the original scary concept is that everybody was in bed unjostled by the shotgun blasts in the other room. And so if the house was sedating them and, you know, making them available.
Now they think that's not particularly true, and it was actually just really terrible and horrible, and he literally killed these children while they were like lined up trying to get out of the room.
Yeah. So it'll never be as nasty as the original story. But yeah, I don't know. This one, I feel like time hurt this one on account of the 1,000 versions and variations and even urban myths around it.
Sure.
So I don't know what I was expecting, but yeah, I mean, it was okay. It was entertaining enough, I guess.
Yeah.
But, I don't think I'd ever watch it again.
I would say I enjoy this movie. I would say definitely watch it if you're a horror movie fan, because it's something that you should see. It's an important film. It's a famous film. So you should watch it. If you want to just watch an abridged version, you know what I would do? I would watch The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, where they go to the house, and it's very similar. And that's what I would do.
The Treehouse of Horror also had a really good Shining episode.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that'll play into the sound drops of this, I'm sure.
Hey, I found a shortcut through a hedge maze.
Get away, you little! No, go easy on the wee one. His father's gonna go crazy and chop them all into haggis.
What's haggis?
Boy, you read my thoughts. You've got the shinning.
You mean shining.
Shh! You wanna get sued?
This one was suggested by you, and I side-eyed you a little when you suggested this, but I'm on board now. I'm on board. 2006 cartoon animation Monster House.
Yeah. I thought it would break up some of the tension of this, and it's on theme.
Yeah, and it is. It was directed by Gil Kenan, written, though, by Dan Harmon from Rick and Morty fame.
Yeah.
And a few other Rick and Morty kind of people joining the party. Rob Schraub is in there, too.
Yeah. It sounds like him and Harmon had come up with the story together.
Yeah, and I was really surprised as I started digging around.
Yeah, there's a lot of, and this was sort of like ushered through by Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis, so like, yeah, it had some weight. I guess Zemeckis before this had done The Polar Express, which freaked everybody out because the Uncanny Valley made all the humans look really fucked
really
up and weird.
Really weird.
Unsettling.
Really
this,
weird.
Thankfully,
they're
goes in the direction
weird.
Of like claymation aesthetic. So it's kind of like simplified shapes. But like all the physicality of it is really good because all that was motion capture with the actors and the sort of like black box setting.
Right.
And so like all the performances are the performances.
Right. Yeah. But it is still that little weird, you know, like all the people in Toy Story look weird. It's similar to that.
It's like a level removed from trying to be like authentic, real.
Yeah. Great film though. This one, I had never seen it. But I started watching it and really had convinced myself that I had seen it.
Oh, really?
But then things happen and I go, I think I would have remembered this.
Yo!
We're also treated to some awesome voices in the cast.
Yeah, this is filled out like everybody is somebody.
Yeah, the mean old man who lives in the Monster House is actually Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, I didn't realize until halfway through the movie.
Well, Jackson leaned over and he was like, is that Steve Buscemi? And I was like, I don't know. And then I Googled it and he was right. And so then I didn't tell him till later. The parents of the main kid, DJ, the absentee parents that have gone and left the kid alone, is Catherine O'Hara and Fred Willard.
Yeah.
So it's like right out of a Christopher Guest film. There you go.
It's funny. It took me a little while to get into the movie because I spent the first half going,
Who is that voice? Yeah.
Who is that? That sounds like Fred Willard, but he's doing a weird... I guess it is him. Yeah, that was a lot of the first half of the movie for me. I should have just watched the goddamn movie and let that be that.
It starts out with a little girl on a tricycle. Very horror-like.
Yeah, very much like the 1990 made-for-TV It, which we had just spoken about on our Patreon episode.
Little girl on a tricycle going past a scary, scary old house.
Yeah, I love it because it's kind of archetypal in terms of like every town had kind of a fucked up house that was neglected, maybe abandoned, and you know maybe burnouts would sort of use it to like fuck around in and graffiti the walls.
And you dare people to go inside.
Yeah.
Things like that.
In this case, like it's a pretty substantial house in the middle of the suburbs. Like there's more development happening nearby, but otherwise, like it's just this one house that stands out, and you're not allowed to go on the lawn because the old man is watching.
Yeah. So her tricycle hits a rock, which was terrible. Because then I thought, oh my god, is this girl dead? Because I didn't
a weird
really
way to start an animated.
I didn't
movie.
Really understand if it was
girl
like
breaks neck
animated
on rock.
Like for kids or if it was animated for like adult people. I really didn't know what I was in for. So I thought, is this like Rango? Is this for adult people? Is this for kids? Did this girl just die? Which is actually what I thought. And we'll talk about there's actually a lot of death in this film. But she doesn't die. Steve Buscemi comes out, takes her tricycle, and breaks it in half.
He's a pretty strong old man. Like, he snapped
really
the tricycle
mean.
In two pieces with his bare hands.
He's
yeah.
like really,
all the
meanwhile really
screaming
mean.
At her. Like, it was, yeah, it was pretty scary.
So we have DJ, who lives across the street, who's always watching this old man, also taking photos of him.
Yeah, I thought it was going to go in the direction of, like, a rear window.
Yeah.
Yeah, not so much.
Introduced also to his friend, who wears a cape for no reason that I can figure out.
Yeah.
Chowder is what they name that kid.
Yeah, Chowder's, Yeah, I don't know who does that to a kid.
And did you have friends that had just a weird name like that? Like a food type name?
No. No.
Me either,
I don't
but in movies, they always do.
Like, you would get an abbreviation. Like I was D. I never right. agreed to it. It just became my friends being lazy. I don't know. But Chowder is like some mean dad watches like his toddler eat chowder, and he's just like, he loves that chowder.
Chowder.
From now on, you're Chowder.
Like tuna, you know? It's
yeah.
like, why are we calling them these weird names?
Even an ice cream man, they make fun of him for a nickname he had no say in getting. They're like, who names their kid Tuna? No one. That's who.
Well,
no
this
one.
Kid with a cape is named Chowder.
Chowder with the cape. And his hair bothered me. But again, like going to the animation style where it's not like individual pieces of hair. It's not going to that depth in the
right.
animation. It looks a little bit like a Lego snap-on head of hair.
Yeah, that's kind of, he's got a receding hairline at 10 years old. It was weird. And then their babysitter, Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
She joins the party, and she's the meanest babysitter ever.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what they were going for, but I guess, yeah, as far as isolating these kids even mm-hmm. further, and I mean, it, yeah. So this story, we recently talked about it and the Stephen King sort of our gang versus evil component that he kind of started.
That's on our Patreon page. You can be a patron. At patreon.com/transmacabre. Oh, I didn't mean to. You should. I thought that
no,
you'd
I'll
go
there.
Right back into it.
So as far as a group of kids with the adversary of this house in this case, or you know, whatever evil is present to them, yeah, in this case, like it's kind of in the theme of it, where like it's not just the big baddie. There mm-hmm. are other mini bosses along the way
yeah.
that they've got to deal with. And the sister and her skull or bones was the
babysitter.
Right. I thought it was a sister at first. But the babysitter, Maggie Gyllenhaal's boyfriend.
Yes.
That's voiced
Jason
by Jason Lee.
Yeah.
And I think his name is Bones. But yeah,
yeah
everybody's a dick to these kids.
Yeah. Everyone's really mean to them. But they also ask stupid questions. So you think to yourself, are they just being rude or they've just had enough? We're only seeing these kids at one small shot. And maybe...
Yeah, the story only takes place across
yeah,
like 2 days.
Maybe they're very annoying and that's why she's so mean to them. You don't know because that Chowder seems like bad.
Well, no. I think Chowder, judging by how reluctant he is to do anything, I think actually Chowder's the one who keeps your kid out of trouble.
That's probably true.
Because he's talking him out of his poor decisions.
Because he just sits there and does nothing.
He's a scaredy cat.
The haunting is subtle, yet really, really boring. Can I go home now?
Chowder, she'll hear you.
DJ, this is why nobody will sit next to us at lunch.
Early on in the movie, DJ confronts the old man, Steve Buscemi, and I really thought he died on him.
I think, well, that's fair. We're led to...
Many times in this movie, I thought to myself, first, at the very beginning, I go, oh, is this a story of a little girl who hit her head on the sidewalk and died? Then
it's all a Jacob's Ladder. She's yeah. just like a quadriplegic in her hospital bed,
like, is
envisioning
this the story?
All these things.
And then when the old man dies on the kid, or you think the old man dies on the kid, I thought, oh, this is a story of kids coming to term with an old man that died on them. And they've got to get therapy and go through life like this. It's very serious.
Okay, at which point Monster House is more of a metaphor. But yeah, in this case, it's quite literally... I was surprised how early they show that the house itself is alive.
Yes.
And I love that the house, when it's not being animated, it's a pretty unassuming house. It's generally like ugly and plain, and it seems like it has like too few windows.
Yes.
And then when it starts, like when the porch starts becoming teeth and the windows, the eyes,
it's scary,
like it's
scary, actually. It's really like if you were yeah. a kid watching this, you'd think that was scary shit, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this was animated for 3D. So this was
oh,
probably a great
fun.
Theater experience.
Yeah, that would have been yeah. fun. We also find out a little bit about Cheddar's family and his
Chowder.
Cheddar is what I called him, Chowder.
Cheddar's a different character. Cheddar's in The Wire. Cheddar is Method Man in The Wire.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, that's not who I'm talking about. I'm talking about Chowder in this film. When they start talking about his family, you find out his mom is at the movies with her personal trainer. That's what he says. Because they ask where his mom is, and that's what he tells. And he's totally cool. Like, he thinks there's nothing.
That's funny because that is so much like the like cleaned up, edited for TV version of like, my mom's fucking her trainer.
Yeah, exactly. The tennis pro.
They're in a hotel room.
And then later on, as it goes, the house takes all their things. It takes someone's kite at one point. It takes the tricycle.
Childhood happiness. These sort of tome. These icons of like childhood joy.
Right.
Can't have them around.
And then you find out when Jason Lee leaves the house, when his character leaves the house, he's drinking. He's lured into the house. The house goes out of its way to go get him.
Yeah.
By his red kite that he lost like 10 years ago.
I felt like that was right out of It.
It was so It. I wrote down, it's like It, but it's also sort of like Needful Things. It's like a combination of all those things. But I thought that bright red kite, and then he goes right into it. Bad. Yeah.
So not to give spoilers as far as the origins of the house itself, because all that stuff is actually really fun. I was kind of impressed by the long memory of the house, because it really sadistic asshole, that monster house.
Yeah, that monster house is no good. It eats a dog at one point in time. There's things I need to talk. It eats some police officers.
Yep.
And
seemingly with few repercussions.
Some people we see again, but some people we never see again. And am I to believe those people have died and been eaten by the house?
Well, I don't want to spoil it, but it feels like you missed a little something towards the end. It was just, it was Nick Cannon and Kevin James, yeah. I think, were the voices of those two guys.
Can we talk about those cops?
Yeah, I mean, these were cops, like, out of a Wes Craven movie, just as far as, like, bumbling assholes.
Terrible, idiot cops. But really weirdly awful was Nick Cannon's cop.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that was a weird choice.
Lots of things going on. I didn't care for the way that it was acted.
Didn't he point his gun at the kids at some point?
Yeah, he does. He's going to shoot everybody all the time. That's his, like, big go-to.
Problem solved.
And Kevin James has to talk him out of it.
You hear that?
Yep, it's my stomach. I'm starving.
No. That sounds like the dangerous creature. I'm going to go check it out.
Just like trying to wrangle a puppy. All right, I'll be back.
Doesn't he say he's like new on the job? Yeah,
he's brand new. Yeah,
still not okay. I think they deal with that pretty early on and as cadets.
So I'm okay. Like if the cops really do never come back, I'm okay with that too.
So this movie was nominated for both an Oscar and a Golden Globe for Best Animated Feature, but it didn't win either. That said, like, this is fun.
It's fun.
I like this as a sort of break from it. It's very much on theme. But yeah, it was a PG-13 movie. It's scary. It's legit scary at times. The house is really well animated. And the story, you know, it gets a nice bit of story.
The story is pretty
30 minutes.
Weird and brutal and gross. Like, if you were a little kid watching that, you'd be like, whoa. Huh,
yeah.
Whoa.
Are you a Rick and Morty fan?
I am a Rick and Morty fan.
Yeah. I mean, Rick and Morty is working on a number of more levels than this. But yeah, Dan Harmon, he's always had it. I was a huge Community. I'm still a huge Community fan. Yeah, Dan Harmon. Yeah, the writing is strong.
Yeah. It's a good story. A nice twist also. I'll say that. Does not Shyamalan you in the head.
I liked where it went. So as things sometimes happen, this episode went pretty long, so we will be coming back next week with our episode on The Shining.
And here is a preview of what's to come.
And on to more pressing matters than Monster House. We're going to go for it. We clearly will not be the definitive take on The Shining. It is too massive a tome to completely be gone over in a single podcast. So we are approaching this as fans. We are presuming you, the listener, have seen The Shining.
Yes.
And by that I mean the made-for-TV Stephen Weber Shining.
We're not talking about the Stephen Weber Shining.
I gotcha.
I was like,
I wasn't sure how long I should hold that.
My notes don't have anything to do with that. I got really worried. I was like, oh, shit. I thought that with Amity at first, too. Like, I was like, I hope he's talking about this, Amity.
Perhaps we could talk more between episodes. No, I was pulling your line. Oh, yes, of course. God. The 1980 Stanley Kubrick, The Shining.
I was like, I saw your notes, man.
Your eyes. Until then, you can keep track with us on social media all over. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Rants Macabre. Our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Drop us a line or a Facebook posting. Recently, we got an earful from, from, I guess, no longer a fan. It sounds like he's done with us.
No, he is done listening to
us. He had an issue specifically with your... you're like championing 28 Days Later into our top 25.
He did not like my championing anything, but especially not 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
But don't come for my Cillian Murphy like that.
Well, his strangest thing was that he was against the plot of 28 Days Later,
right,
suggesting that the general was actually the most unrealistic thing about that story.
My thinking was, oh my gosh, if he thinks I'm a terrible person for championing 28 Days Later, woo, if he gets to see Calvert, I don't know how he's going to take it.
I want to be with him when he gets into New French Extremity. Yeah. And yeah, no, but by that measure, I'm really glad that we got both Martyrs and Calvert on our top 25.
Woo.
So suck it. I don't remember your name. But yeah, so join us next week where we'll be talking exclusively about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.